quorum yet, but since we're not taking any action on any bills today, I think it's okay to get started. So joining us today, we have Gary Goldsmith and Jeff Sigurdsson. Did I say that right correctly, Jeff?
Yes,
Mr. Sigurdsson. From the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. So thank you, members, for being here, and we look forward to your overview today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I'm happy to be here with you this afternoon. What we will be doing today is, first of all, Mr. Sigurdsson will give you an introduction to the board and to the board members and talk a little bit about what the board does, what the scope of its jurisdiction is under Chapter 10A, which the legislature has provided for the board. Then I will talk about campaign finance law in general, how we go about regulating, and by that I mean how you go about regulating, what some of the constitutional principles are that govern when you can regulate and when you cannot, and to try to explain to you where Minnesota's law is compared to the law of other states and the law in the federal government. I will briefly touch on our legislative recommendations in some general terms, although they are not in bill form yet. I'll give you a little information about our scheduling on that and be able to take questions about those. And then finally, I will take a moment at the end to comment on our budget situation, although that's not directly relevant to this committee. It will certainly be a topic of concern because the legislative recommendations include quite a few new initiatives, all of which are going to take staff resources, which means they cost money. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Sigurdsson to give you an introduction to the board.
And excuse me, Mr. Sigurdsson, I'd just like to announce that a quorum is present. So thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jeff Sigurdsson. I'm the Assistant Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As I give a relatively brief overview of the three main programs that the board administers, I will be making reference to a couple of handouts that you should have in front of you. One is the color one showing the various board members, and then there's also a one-page document titled Overview of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, which is a very rough outline of the material that I'll be presenting. It does have most of the hard numbers, which I'll be referring to, so if there's something that catches your ear in terms of the presentation, that information should be encapsulated in that sheet. The board enabling legislation was passed in 1974, basically in response to the problems that occurred during the Watergate era. It's Chapter 10A, which is referred to as the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The board's mission, which I want to take a little bit of time talking about because it relates so much to the three programs that the board administers, is to promote public confidence in state government decision-making through development, administration, and enforcement of disclosure and public financing programs, which will ensure public access to and understanding of information filed with the board. Again, I think as we go through this, you'll see that all three programs relate to that basic mission. Before going into those three programs, I did want to introduce you a little bit to the board members, which again is the color print-off. The board has six members. All are appointed by the governor. The board members are unique in that they have to be confirmed by both the Senate and the House, and a three-fifths majority is required to confirm those appointments by the governor. And in fact, one position will be before this committee this year, or at least we assume that the governor will make a replacement appointment this year, and that individual will be before you. The board is bipartisan. No more than one half of the members may be affiliated with any one particular political party. We're required to have one former DFL legislator, one former Republican legislator, two members who have not been politically active for at least 3 years, and two members who support different political parties. If you look at the list, or again the handout, our new board chair who just became into that position in January is Andy Luger. He's an attorney in Minneapolis. We have Senator Weiner, who is the former DFL legislator, fills that spot. We have John Scanlon, who's an attorney with 3M. We have Greg McCullough, who was the chair in 2012, a very, very stressful year for the board. He is now the position that will be up before you later this year. We also have Representative Peterson, who is the former Republican member. And then we have George Beck, who is a retired member of the Office of Administrative Hearings, a judge without organization. We'll go through their biographies in depth. Obviously, it's just information for you. But I do want to say that the board members work extremely hard. It's not unusual for, the board has meetings on a monthly basis, for the background packets of information before the board to be over 300 pages in length is not unusual. And it takes a lot of dedication for them to wade through that. And I think that we've always been impressed, when I say we, I mean staff, has always been impressed by the quality of individuals that the governor's offices, the various governors at this point, have appointed to the board, and very thankful for that. To support the board in their actions in carrying out Chapter 10A, the board currently has 7.6 staff members. And again, we have three basic programs, the first of which is the campaign finance program, which, of course, is the one which you are most familiar with. This is disclosure of the campaign finance to the public of information of associations and political committees and funds, the money that they've raised, the money that they've spent, the type of support they're providing to candidates, political parties, and ballot questions and independent expenditures. Again, it provides the public with information and disclosure and transparency on the influences on the election and the type of pressures that there are in terms of electing people to the legislature. Currently, we have 755 state-level candidates registered with the board. That number is actually down somewhat as people terminate after unsuccessful bids in 2012. We had over 950 earlier in the year. There's 329 political party units registered with the board. There's 355 political committees and funds. And then we have two other sort of more limited scope committees and funds registered with the board, and that's the ballot question committees and funds. There are 26 of those. And then there are 31 independent expenditure committees and funds. And those last two organizations are allowed to take corporate funds. The others are not. The board also administers and distributes funds for the public subsidy program. In 2012, that was $1,950,000 that were given out to legislative candidates, somewhat less than a year in which the constitutional officers were on the ballot in 2010. That number was a little bit over $4 million. So not having a governor and the other constitutional officers does lower the amount. To provide support to the individuals who are involved in the campaign finance program, The board has several service strategies. The first is to recognize the nature of campaign finance for political committees and funds, especially candidates' committees in Minnesota. And by that, I mean that almost all treasurers are volunteers, which means that they have other duties, other jobs, frankly, greater priorities in most cases than running the political committee of a legislator. With that in mind, the board tries to tailor its training to meet their schedule, to provide them with the information that they can do to keep the committees of the legislators out of trouble and to meet all the compliance requirements of Chapter 10A. The board did provide 51 training sessions during this last election cycle to both compliance training for the treasurers and then also in the use of the campaign finance reporter software, which is developed and provided by the board free of charge to any committee or fund registered with the board. Campaign Finance Reporter is an important part of that support for the volunteer treasurer. It has built-in compliance tools so that it checks all contributions and expenditures to make sure that they comply with the statute. It also, of course, generates an electronic report, which helps us in terms of processing the report and getting that information out onto the website and available for public disclosure. Further support is provided through the advisory opinion process. There's over 400 advisory opinions at this point on the website that can be searched by key terms and by topic area. And any interested party who has a stake in the outcome of the advisory opinion can ask for an advisory opinion for an advisory opinion from the board. And that's the way that the board provides support in more complicated issues. The board does, in the end, also provide compliance to Chapter 10A, especially the campaign finance area. There were, in 2012, 26 conciliation agreements issued to candidates. Conciliation agreements are relatively minor violations, usually involving excess contributions, perhaps excess expenditures, that are self-reported typically by the candidates, and then we use those conciliation agreements to clear the violation and apply whatever penalty is appropriate. On top of the conciliation agreements, the board also issued 32 findings. Findings are much more typically are much more complicated. They involve investigations, taking of testimony, often a lot of testimony, to find out exactly what happened in a particular scenario. There were 32, again, of those issued in 2012. All of this ends up being on the board website. The disclosure and the compliance information in terms of penalties that are assigned or conclusions of investigations are put onto the board's website. There's over 5,800 campaign finance reports were filed with the board in 2012. Once they're received, the day after the filing period, they're available as a PDF on the board's website the day afterwards. The year-end reports are still coming in, but it looks like the total expenditures in 2012 will exceed $75 million on campaigns. That's a record. Of that amount, approximately, and again, this is with not final reports, but at this point, it looks like approximately $15 million will have been spent on the constitutional amendments this year and over $9 million on independent expenditures. The second program that the board also administers, which is moving from the realm of election to then the legislative process, is the lobbying program. The lobbying program provides information to the public on the individuals and associations that are attempting to affect official actions by the legislature, by the administrative agencies when they pass administrative rules, and by the metropolitan governmental units. Only the county boards and first-class cities of the seven-county metro area are covered by Chapter 10A. Any city or county outside of that area, in fact, are not covered by the lobbying provisions at all of Chapter 10A. There are currently approximately 1,250 registered lobbyists that are registered with the board. That number changes pretty much daily at the beginning of the session. A couple of days ago, I believe we received 90 registrations on a single day, so that number is in flux. They represent approximately 1,400 principals. Principals are associations which hire lobbyists. The lobbyists provide two disbursement reports to us a year, and then the principals provide one report per year. In 2011, which was the last year that we have complete numbers for, there was over $65 million in lobbying disbursements made in Minnesota. Compliance here is typically securing reports, responding to complaints on failure to register of individuals who other individuals believe should be a lobbyist, and then providing guidance on the gift prohibition, which is another part of the lobbying provisions, which is the gift prohibition between lobbyists and public officials. And then third and last of the programs, or at least the major programs administered by the board, is the Economic Interest Program. This, again, is providing disclosure to the public on the potential conflicts of interest that may exist with public officials. The idea here is that the transparency and disclosure will reassure the public that the public officials are making official decisions on the basis that's the best thing for Minnesota and not on the basis that it may be of some advantage to them personally. Statements of economic interest are for both candidates and elected state office holders, commissioners, deputy and assistant commissioners, executive officers of any agency that has the authority to adopt administrative rules, local officials, again, of just metropolitan governmental units, not of greater Minnesota, and other governmental boards and commissions as listed in statute. We currently have 2,397 public officials, 201 of which, of course, are members of the legislature. 270 governmental units have public officials and therefore assist the board in receiving a public or economic interest statements from those officials. The economic statements are again placed on the website. The disclosure provided is information on the occupation of the public official, any associated business, which is defined as anything that provides over $50 a month in compensation, securities of $2,500 or more, although the value of the security is not provided, the listing of the security is, non-homesteaded property in Minnesota, and then an interest in any parimutuel horse racing is also provided. Reports are filed when an individual first becomes an official and then has an April, every year on April, there's an obligation to update any changes. That application is again available on the board's website. Compliance here is primarily securing reports and responding to questions on appropriate disclosure for those public officials who are just now coming into the system. That, Madam Chair and board members or committee members, is again just an overview of the board's functions. If there's not any questions on that, then Mr. Goldsmith has the second part of our presentation.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will want to talk a little bit now about where Minnesota is with regard to campaign finance regulation, because a large part of the board's recommendations, the most substantive parts of the board's recommendations, have to do with disclosure. And so what I'd like to do, because when we have bills in this committee, we'll be talking about fairly technical concepts, and I'd like to give you now the background that will help you understand those, and then we won't have to go over those sort of concepts as we hear the actual bills. You'll understand better why certain things are in the bill and why certain things are not in the bill. Campaign finance, and I'm talking about in this talk campaign finance regulation. I'm not talking about the lobbying program or the economic interest program. Everything we do to regulate campaign finance really goes back to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the protection for freedom of speech, where the Constitution says Congress may enact no law abridging the freedom of speech, and by the 14th Amendment, that's extended to the states. So if we start with a law saying you can't pass a law abridging speech, and as soon as we start regulating campaign finance communications, we're going to bump up against that constitutional provision. And this really came to a head in the early 70s after Watergate, which was a political scandal at the federal level. President Nixon's committee, the Committee to Re-elect the President, was involved in a burglary. You might remember hearing about, some of you at least will remember that, at the Watergate Hotel in Washington. And in the course of the investigation, it found that this committee had slush funds with cash. Cash was used to pay the burglars and to pay their defense costs. And so the whole concept of free-flowing cash in the federal election system was brought to light before the public. And there was a lot of public outrage, and of course that means there was a lot of sympathy for some new law or new system that would start to regulate this money in the political process. And so at the federal level, that system was put into place. And in fact, in 1974, Minnesota put into place the predecessor of Chapter 10A, which very, very closely resembled the federal law. As with most new laws in the campaign finance area, it was challenged right away. And in 1976, the case of Buckley versus Vallejo, which is still the grandfather of campaign finance cases, reached the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was asked to rule on quite a few of the provisions of the federal law, and in doing so, it established some principles that bind us now in everything we do. And one of the first ones that many people still disagree with, but it's a firm principle of constitutional law now, is that when you're talking about political speech, money equals speech. That's what the Buckley Court said. The Buckley Court said you can't speak effectively without money. So as soon as you try to regulate money, from our perspective, it's the same thing as directly regulating speech. So the argument that we're just regulating money doesn't work anymore. So when we regulate money, we regulate political speech. The Buckley Court looked at a couple of different types of groups, and we are constantly looking at those types of groups here in Minnesota. And in fact, we looked at them closely during the ballot questions and on an ongoing basis. The first type of group is the group that is organized to influence elections. We call that a major purpose association because its major purpose is to influence elections. In Minnesota, those would be your candidate committees, party units, and political committees, which are groups that form specifically to influence the election. And those are a pretty easy group to regulate because the Buckley Court said, by definition, everything that they do is to influence an election, so you can validly ask them about all of their receipts and all of their expenditures. And that's about what we do in Minnesota with certain thresholds. The bigger problem was presented by another group that didn't exist to influence elections. It would be like a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, like an interest group. They exist for some other purpose, and we refer to them as non-major purpose associations. These associations also might want to spend some of their money on campaigns, and under the law in Buckley, it looked like even they would be required to report every receipt and every expenditure, even though most of that was for some purpose unrelated to elections. The Buckley Court didn't think that that was consistent with our constitutional principles, that we would be infringing on non-election type speech, too much if we permitted that. And so it said with respect to those groups that you can regulate their speech if it expressly advocates for or against the election of a candidate. And so that's a concept that's known as express advocacy. And in a footnote to the case, the Buckley court said, you can tell if something is express advocacy if it uses words such as vote for, vote against, support, elect, defeat, and other words like that. Those were in a footnote, but they were elevated to very important status in subsequent cases. In fact, in subsequent cases, they were called the magic words of Buckley, and that's what we still mean when we talk about the magic words. And whether an advertisement includes or doesn't include the magic words has something to do with whether we can get disclosure about that advertisement. And I'm getting to how that trickles down to Minnesota in particular. There were a couple of other important holdings in Buckley. One is states may limit the amount of money that each donor can give to a candidate. And in Minnesota, of course, we do that. States also may limit the amount of money that each donor can give to a party unit. And in Minnesota, we have never done that. There were provisions in the federal law that were stricken, and Minnesota likewise. There were spending limits, not under a public subsidy agreement like we have, but statutory spending limits for candidates on their elections. And those were stricken because the court determined it was unconstitutional to limit how much a person could spend to get elected. Also, the limit on how much a person could contribute to their own committee, even though you can limit how much other people contribute, you cannot limit how much a person can contribute to his or her own campaign committee. And you cannot limit how much any association spends on independent expenditures. So those are certain principles that were laid down. Now, in Minnesota, we've worked with those by instituting a public subsidy program where candidates voluntarily agree to limits on spending and agree to limit the amount they use for their own campaign in exchange for getting money from the general treasury of the state. A couple of things that were not challenged in the Buckley case, and that was the prohibition on corporate and union independent expenditures and on contributions to candidates by those groups. That was so ingrained at that time in federal law that it wasn't even raised as an issue, and we know that changed. In Minnesota, we have never had a complete prohibition on union independent expenditures or contributions as long as they're consistent with other law, and there is some disclosure in some cases, but there's never been a prohibition. So Minnesota's prohibition has been on the corporate side. After Buckley, the federal law was modified substantially to remove the unconstitutional provisions and make it consistent with Buckley. And Minnesota's law was modified as well. And that was in 1976. So some of the biggest changes in Chapter 10A occurred in 1976. And one of those changes that we're still dealing with today is the recognition of these two types of organizations. So on the one hand, we have campaign committees or political committees, and we can regulate and get disclosure of most everything that they do. On the other hand, we have associations who have some other major purpose. And under Minnesota law, we can regulate the money that they actually use for political purposes, but not any of their other money. And the money they use for political purposes is called their political fund. So in Minnesota, we have political committees where we get disclosure of everything, and political funds, which is simply an account of money used by a non-major purpose association. And we can get disclosure of the money that's used in that account, but not everything else that they do. Also, if you remember, the Buckley court said that for these non-major purpose associations, we can regulate the express advocacy that they do. Well, that was actually codified into Minnesota law very explicitly in the definition of independent expenditure. So in Minnesota law, an independent expenditure is, by definition, an expenditure that expressly advocates for the election or defeat of a candidate. And the words expressly advocates are in our statute. Now, the board, because of the timing of that definition and because of the way the law is written, the board has, up to this point, concluded that that means an independent expenditure has to use the magic words vote for, vote against, and so on. Quite a few years ago, The board had a major investigation in the matter of the complaint of Novak regarding Minnesota Majority, and the board found that the materials Minnesota Majority published were not, in fact, independent expenditures because there was no express advocacy. Now, the law has changed quite a bit since Buckley at the state, at the federal level and the constitutional level, but Minnesota is stuck in a time warp with respect to the scope of disclosure that we get from these non-major purpose associations. I do think that with respect to the express advocacy question, the board could improve the disclosure there, or the scope of disclosure, by administrative rule, but we would certainly prefer that that happen through the legislative process, and we have a recommendation on that. Well, what happened after Buckley, of course, is what we already see in Minnesota, is that everybody was running ads that just avoided the magic words. They looked for every purpose like a campaign ad, but they didn't say vote for or vote against or anything like that. And so it took Congress a while, but in 2002, McCain-Feingold was passed, actually called the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, but commonly known as McCain-Feingold, and that tried to get at the scope of disclosure that could be obtained. And so McCain-Feingold defined a new kind of advertising called electioneering communications, and it didn't have to use the words of advocacy or advocate in any way. All it had to do was name a candidate clearly identified, be run 30 days before the primary or 60 days before the general election, and be distributed to the electorate, meeting a certain threshold for distribution. And that was electioneering communications. Well, as you might expect, that was challenged as well right away. And that was challenged in McConnell, and that is, in fact, Mitch McConnell versus FEC, who was joined by many other associations on both sides of the spectrum as we look at disclosure, challenging that provision. And part of the challenge was that the provision also prohibited corporations and unions from making this kind of expenditure, which was quite a bit different than express advocacy. So we already said corporations can't expressly advocate. Now we're saying you can't even talk about a candidate during those periods before the election. And so corporations challenged that. Well, what the McConnell court said was, first of all, you don't need the magic words. That wasn't really constitutional law. That was just a way we narrowed a vague definition of expenditure. If the advertisement we're looking at uses express advocacy or is the functional equivalent, so we would say it's really the same thing as express advocacy, you can get disclosure and you can regulate those as well. And so McConnell said that with respect to these electioneering communications ads, most of them look like express advocacy, and so mostly they're probably all right. It was a little bit vague on that. You have to read the opinion several times, and it's still not clear. What was clear, however, was that they said, what was clear is that the words of express advocacy were no longer needed, and the scope of communications that you could get disclosure about was broadened. Now, Minnesota didn't change its law at the time of the McCain-Feingold Act and didn't change its law at the time of the McConnell decision. And by the way, McConnell continued to uphold the prohibition on corporations making this type of speech. We then moved further toward the present to 2007, and Justice Roberts is the Chief Justice of the court. And he writes an opinion in Wisconsin, Right to Life, which really solidifies the fact that the magic words are no longer needed. And he says that if an ad can be believed by any reasonable, let me quote it. If the ad is susceptible to no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a candidate, you can get disclosure about that ad. Again, Minnesota law didn't change, so we're still in the position of requiring the magic words of express advocacy. And finally, Citizens United. Citizens United did two things. One thing that people who want less money and more regulation in campaign finance law didn't like, and one thing that they did like. Of course, the one that many people didn't like is the fact that they struck down the prohibition on corporate independent expenditures and corporate electioneering communications, essentially saying that corporate speech is entitled to the same protection as individual speech. They did not reach the question of direct corporate contributions because that question was not before the court. So corporate direct contributions to candidates and parties are still prohibited, although that is under challenge. And I am very worried, I shouldn't say worried, it's my belief that when that reaches the Supreme Court, there's a very good chance that that prohibition will be stricken as well, on the same basis that Citizens United struck the prohibition, that is that it distinguishes between kinds of speakers, and you can't make those distinctions based on the kind of speaker. Minnesota adjusted its independent expenditure law to permit corporate independent expenditures, and we still maintain our prohibition on direct contributions. To show you graphically where these lines are, I prepared a graphic that you've been given with four photos of ads that actually ran. First of all, I want to make it clear that every one of these ads was perfectly legal, and the disclosure that was provided, if it was the right disclosure, and if it wasn't provided, it was because the advertiser was not required to provide disclosure under Minnesota law. But I want to use these to demonstrate how the board is proposing that we would change our disclosure law to bring it up to the level that's permitted by the current constitutional law theory and the holdings of the court. So the first document is an independent expenditure. You've seen these. It's very much like a regular campaign expenditure, except somebody else runs the ad. And, of course, at the bottom it says vote for the candidate. So it uses those magic words of express advocacy. And this would be subject to regulation. And if the person running the communication wasn't registered with the board, it might trigger a registration requirement. The next ad was run in the 2012 race, in a House race, by an individual who told us in an investigation that he wanted to level the playing field. In our thoughts, that leveling the playing field in an election can't be much different than trying to influence that election for whoever one thinks isn't on the level playing field. And it's pretty clear from this ad, contrasting two candidates, one clearly negatively and one clearly positively, that this ad was intended to influence the election. However, it doesn't use the magic words. There's no vote for, vote against, or anything like that. And in the board's investigation, we did conclude that under the current law, unless the legislature changes it or the board adopts administrative rules, this type of disclosure, this type of advertising would not trigger a registration requirement and is not subject to disclosure. And this was something that concerns the board, and it's for that reason in part that, that not just this ad, but many ads like this that the board is bringing forth its legislative recommendations. The next page is a billboard, which actually ran up on Highway 55 in the Maple Lake area. It's interesting. I have a question mark as to whether it's the functional equivalent of express advocacy or not. I think my own personal opinion would be that it is because it was run right during the election cycle. What other purpose would one have but to encourage people to vote for a particular candidate? On the other hand, if the billboard had said, "Thank you, Senator, for your work on behalf of the citizens," one would argue then that it has some other purpose, just to convince people to call the senator and express their appreciation. And, in fact, that's what was happening at the federal level. And you've seen them. They still exist. It's the ads that say, call Senator Feingold and thank him for opposing a filibuster or for this or for that. And it's those ads that are really the target of the federal electioneering communication law. And that's the last document on my handout. This looks like a campaign ad in many ways, except it doesn't. It names a specific, clearly identified candidate. It talks about why the candidate has done good things in her capacity as a representative. It gives you her contact information, and then it says call her to thank her. Likewise, this ad would not be subject to disclosure or trigger any registration requirements in Minnesota because it is not express advocacy. And, in fact, it's not the functional equivalent of express advocacy because a reasonable person could look at this and say, hey, they just want to thank the representative for what she's done, and that's a good idea. However, it would fall under the definition of electioneering communications because it names a clearly identified candidate. is run in the relevant time period before the primary general election, and it was targeted, in fact, mailed to the relevant electorate. It's these two types of things, the functional equivalent of independent expenditures and the electioneering communication option, that the board is recommending be brought within the disclosure system. I am working on bills. They will go to the revisor's office probably tomorrow to be put into the form of bills, and then we expect that we will have those bills before the committee. I will give you a little bit on the timing, I think. My plan is to develop a bill that's very technical in nature that corrects some drafting things that occurred in the last session, a couple of minor late filing fee issues and some things like that that really is very routine, and that would come before you as a separate bill because it will, I think, not be in the least controversial. And then the main board recommendations will be in a larger bill, which will be the main bill that you'll be discussing here, and that will get to the revisor this week. I will be away for most of next week, and so we would be ready to meet at any time, and I'll be meeting with members after next week. And then the final piece of our major recommendations has to do with the public integrity piece, sometimes referred to as economic interest or conflict of interest, but when it boils down to it, what we're really talking about is ensuring the citizens of Minnesota that the people we elect to office serve with integrity, that they aren't influenced by financial interests outside of their office that might make them make a decision in their own interest rather than in their interest of the state and their constituents. That piece, the board has recommended improvements to the disclosure program and to the economic public integrity program. However, the board wanted staff to come back to it with specific bill language so that they would see what the new language for that program would look like, because we've concluded that, at least from the board's perspective, there are many things that need to be fixed in the economic interest program, including making the triggers clear as to when filings are due and so on. So what we're proposing to bring back and the board will look at on February 5th is a bill that would completely remodel that program. Much of what you're familiar with would still be there. Some of it will be clearer, and there would be some new things as well that would address concerns the board has had over the last few years as it's looked at this issue in a few matters of investigation. I will take a lot more specific questions on that in just a moment if you have them. I will also be happy to go over other legislative recommendations in more detail. I think we have mailed to each of you a copy of the legislative recommendations, so if you haven't seen it, ask your legislative assistant to dig out a copy or contact me for an additional copy. They did go out last week, I believe, or maybe the beginning of this week, but I think last week. We are recommending a couple of major changes to help improve the candidate's ability to have the candidate's own voice heard above the fray of independent spending in an election. We saw in this last election that independent spending in several races outstripped candidate spending, and candidates conveyed the sentiment that they were, in fact, being defined by others than themselves because their voices couldn't be heard. To address that, the board has sort of three recommendations. One is that contribution limits and spending limits should be cycle-wide, not per year. If you have a campaign spending limit in a House race, in a Senate race where you have a four-year election cycle, spending that 20% of your limit in the first 3 years is not particularly effective. And in fact, we regularly see candidates trying to spend money in off years in ways that will really benefit them in the final year, like prepaying for radio ads and so on. And we don't like that because oftentimes it's not a bona fide purchase of a service in the off year. So first of all, we would make the spending limit cycle long so you can decide when to spend it, not having that decision made in part by statute. Similarly, the contribution limit would be cycle long so that you will be able to raise your full limit from a donor in the election year if that works best for you, but you would also be able to raise it over the full cycle if that works best for you and your donors. People tend to be more interested in the election year, and at least logic tells me that it might be easier to raise money during that year than in the off years. Finally, in both the campaign spending limit and in the contribution limit, the board is proposing fairly significant increases. They're most significant in the minor constitutional offices, which were always underfunded. That is everything except the gubernatorial office. But, for example, the Senate has a $500 contribution year now in an election year and $100 each other year for a total of $800 for the cycle, and the board is recommending that be increased to $3,000. $1,500 would be the House limit. The spending limit recommendations are more modest. The cycle limit for a senator currently is $108,960. We're recommending that be $120,000. The benefit, I think, partly, though, is that all of that can be spent in the election year when it's really needed and not in those off years. And the board also wants me to convey, as I talk to members in committee, that these limits are the board's recommendation as to the minimum level that those things should be set at. There were members that wanted them significantly higher. Everybody was comfortable with this as a minimum. Many people ask me what the last time contribution limits were changed was, and if you have access, or your LA has access to Senate research publications, Peter Watson did an excellent one quite a while back on the topic, and actually the last time contribution limits were changed was in the 90s, and they were drastically reduced, not increased. For example, the contribution to a gubernatorial campaign at that time could be $60,000, and it went to $2,000. It was part of a big compromise between Governor Carlson and the legislature that also resulted in caps on independent expenditures. However, the courts decided caps on independent expenditures were unconstitutional. In Minnesota, we had a law that said once a party unit has a candidate on the ballot, it can't make independent expenditures. They'll all be considered contributions, and that law was stricken as well. So only the contribution limits portion of that compromise remains. Lastly, I want to say just a couple of words on our budget, which is not the primary topic of this committee. However, many of our recommendations involve adding new responsibilities or expanded responsibilities to the board. To do our job, we have to have the resources that are necessary to do it. And right now, even with the responsibilities we have, we do not have the staff to adequately do the job that we're expected to do. I am not anywhere near satisfied with the job we're doing on many of the tasks. I have a long budget memorandum that I'd be happy to send anyone who likes it, that would like it, that examines, it's a self-examination, really, of how we're doing. And the answer is really not all that well. Not because we don't have great staff, but because we don't have enough people to do what needs to be done. Our base appropriation has been $689,000. I think I gave you also a one-sheet recap of our budget pitch. This is the one-sheet version of the long memo. Our appropriation of $689,000 is almost at its lowest since 2004. There was one period when the new legislature came in 2011 and slashed our budget, but other than that, we're the lowest since 2004. There was a bump up in 2009, which carried into 2010. Some of you may remember, if you were here, that that's the year the board asked the legislature to take $50,000 a year from the public subsidy program and use it for the board's operating budget. We asked that reluctantly, and the board and the legislature did it. Unfortunately, it was all taken away 2 years later, and then some. And the money was not put back into the public subsidy program. It just went back to the general fund. So the board will never ask for that kind of diversion again. I think I can say ever, but I will certainly say ever as long as I'm associated with the board. You can see from a graph on that page, too, our historical staff levels have been generally falling fairly consistently. There's a little blip of a drop in 2012, but that's because of the state government shutdown, so the FTEs during that period don't count. So otherwise, we have a general curve down. And compliance complaints, and these are not board investigations. These are investigations the board does based on complaints, and those are always the most complex investigations that we do. They skyrocketed in 2012, even though only four of those were related to ballot questions. All the rest were related to legislative races, a few lobbying, but mostly legislative races. We're asking the legislature to increase our funding from $689,000 to $1 million a year. That will allow us to go from 7.6 staff to 9, which is not our historic high, but is sufficient to meet both our current obligations and the obligations that would be taken on under the new legislative recommendations. So there'll be a lot more to discuss about that. The board recommends that that be a general fund appropriation. In fact, you will see in the bills that come before you, because it will be in more than one bill, the board recommends that this be a statutory appropriation. We recognize that that's no guarantee of a continuing appropriation. But when we look at what happened when the legislature took $100,000 over 2 years of money that was used for the public subsidy program, put it in the board's budget, and then 2 years later wiped it out and more, the board is very concerned that there's no stability to its agency funding. That's a problem that states around the country try to address, particularly with boards like this that are involved so closely with the political process. The board thinks that one way to maybe get a little more stability would be to make its appropriation statutory rather than part of the budget process. That's no guarantee, and as we know from the contribution refund program, which is a statutory appropriation, it can be changed any time. We would certainly be open to any other suggestions as to how we can stabilize our funding so that we don't take on so many things only to see staff go down, down, down again starting next year or next biennium. Now, when we looked in 2011 at budgeting, and when we looked again as we prepared to work with the governor's office on the executive, on the governor's budget, the board studied very carefully the concept of registration fees for lobbyists and candidates, party units, and committees and funds. To meet the governor's deadline for getting change items into the system, the state has this budget information system, we had to do certain things before the board had finally made their decision. And so we put two possible change items into the system. One was for $1 million with general fund funding. The other one was for $1 million with $350,000 coming from registration fees, and we had to get those in. Once the board made its decision, and before the governor's budget determinations were even coming close to being concluded, we met with the governor's policy staff and with our representatives in Minnesota Management and Budget, made it clear to them that the board's recommendation was not to proceed with registration fees, but rather to seek general fund support for this particular agency. Registration fees, in my opinion, might be appropriate and certainly have been applied over and over again for licensing, permits, things like that. But the scenario there is the person getting the license or the permit is going to engage in some sort of financially related activity that potentially will lead to financial benefit for the person involved. That's commerce. The Campaign Finance Board deals in speech, not commerce. And we think that it would be a mistake to start the down the road towards supporting this agency with registration fees. To get to that point, $350,000, we would have to have a fee of $50 at least per lobbyist client pair. So for some lobbyists, that's way more than $50.
Per year.
There would be tiered system for campaign finance committees, and every version that we looked at wasn't satisfactory. Either the smallest committees were paying what we thought was too much, or the big committees were paying more than we thought they should. It was very, very difficult to get to that target with fees that we thought would be reasonable. We're also concerned about the fact that in campaign finance, there's not a lot of state precedent for imposing fees. There's a handful of states that do it, and I haven't delved into the details of their legislation to see whether they only charge political committees or whether it extends to candidates. The fees tend to be lower than we would need to support our budget with a fee system. On the other hand, the lobbyist fee approach is fairly widely accepted. 42 states have fees on lobbyists of some sort, but the board still decided not to embrace that approach, partly because we know that there are lots of lobbyists out there who register because they want to be on the safe side. They don't know for sure whether they'll meet a threshold. They're over here talking to people, and they want to register. All of those people would drop out of our system. And so the board doesn't recommend a fee system. We will be advocating for the general fund support for our agency. I think that concludes my remarks, Madam Chair. I'll be happy to entertain questions.
Mr. Goldsmith, could you just touch on, please, what was included in the governor's budget recommendations then, or clarify how he proposed coming up with your budget?
What the governor did was accept the change item the board had proposed in the budget system, but then not backed as the way to go forward. And that would actually reduce our general fund appropriation from $689,000 to $650,000, so a small reduction, and then would call for a registration fee system to be put into place to generate $350,000 per year. That's all we get from the governor's office's numbers. I don't expect to see them propose an allocation of fees or anything more than the fact that we should raise that much money through fees.
Thank you. Questions from members? Well, thank you, Mr. Goldsmith and Mr. Sigurdsson. We'll look forward to hearing in a more formal presentation when your bill recommendations are before us. We think likely the first or second week of February, as we discussed.
Yes, I think I will be, as I say, away next week while the reviser is drafting the bill, so I want a few days to make sure they look right, and then, yes, so probably the second week of February.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Members, before we adjourn, I thought we could just, if every member and the staff could go around and introduce yourself for the public and for the committee, why don't we do that first, starting with Senator Kiffmeyer, please? Maybe you could say what district you represent, too.
I am Senator Mary Kiffmeyer, represent Senate District 30, which is the eastern half, pretty much, of Sherburne County and Wright County, including the cities of Big Lake, Elk River, Otsego, St. Michael, Albertville, Hanover, and a little bit of Dayton.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ann Rust, my district is the first, second, and third tier suburbs of Minneapolis.
My name is Scott Newman. I'm from Hutchinson. My district is District 18, which consists of all of Sibley County, all of McLeod County, all of Meeker County, and one township in Wright County.
And I'm Kent Eakin. I'm from Twin Valley up in the northwest. I represent District 4, which is all of Norman County, all of Clay County, and 3.5 townships in Becker County. The two population centers would be Moorhead and Detroit Lakes.
And Senator Eakin is also our vice chair.
Yes.
Janice. I'm Janice Tweed. I'm legislative assistant for Senator Sieben.
And I'm Katie Sieben. I represent Dakota and Washington counties. I live in Cottage Grove.
Jen Bruntlett, and I'm the committee administrator.
Alexis Stengel, I usually go by Lexi, and I'm Senate counsel.
Excuse me. I'm Krista Boyd. I'm legislative analyst for the committee, part of the Senate's nonpartisan staff.
I'm Warren Limmer. I represent Northwest Hennepin County. And I don't know what happened to the other senators here. As soon as I got to the table, they all got up and left.
Well, actually, I know that Senator Hoffman and Senator Hayden both are also in Health and Human Services, which is meeting now. So we will have some conflict with committee times.
I figured, Madam Chair, that if I got a couple others to leave, I could have my way on this committee.
We can touch on that in a minute. And there are pages, please.
Committee Penny Page, Bill Lunzer.
Penny Page, Aaron Gottschall.
And Partisan Research staff, if you want to introduce yourselves to.
Craig Janisich, Senate Depot.
Lucas Nessie, Senator Republican.
Thank you. Well, members, I think just as we look as we go forward next week, a hearing we'll have on election administration and hear from local election officials from the city and county level. And then as you introduce bills related to elections, please email those hearing requests to Jen, the committee administrator. And then I just want to touch on briefly that I think we're in a unique position on the election committee, given that the governor has stated very clearly that he wants election administration bills to be bipartisan. So I hope that we can work very closely together to this legislative session to try to develop some good policy that will work for the entire state. You know, we have this unique responsibility where bills, as indicated by the governor, I think his direction, he's been following previous governors who have said the best election administration bills are bipartisan. Senator Rest.
Well, to that end, Madam Chair, Senator Newman and I have shared information also with Senator Kiffmeyer on the vacancy and nomination issues and been meeting productively with the Secretary of State's office and the House and representatives from the state Republican Party. And I think we're on the way to coming up with something that's going to make sense to all of us. I think Senator Newman would concur in that, I believe.
Senator Newman, I should point out, too, you're the lead Republican on the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Rest's point, yes, we have been meeting. I think that the meetings have been very productive, and I am looking forward to working with all of you towards passing whatever election reform that we are able to do. So great. Thank you very much.
As soon as you're ready for that bill hearing, just let us know. We'll be ready. So with that, the committee is adjourned.